First, I just want to welcome everyone on behalf of Torin Motion. I'm Maxine, the kind of student assistant here. I don't know necessarily what to describe myself as doing a bit of everything, yeah. But we are very pleased to have Rabbi Dr. Lindsay Taylor Goodarts here teaching on an introduction to Islam, of course. Yeah, a really kind of a unique way that we get to look at this. Yeah, I guess like giving space for look at Islam on its own terms, but also that in a way that is, I guess, mindful of our own background knowledge. And yeah, really amazing to get to have this really unique learning opportunity with all of you. Thank you so much for returning, if you indeed are a lot of familiar faces. So yeah, let's go.
Perfect, thanks. So last week, we traced some of the major events that shaped the Muslim world. We looked at the arrival of the Turks and their gradual absorption into Islamic culture. So they've become another, you could say, Islam-bearing set of peoples and culture. We looked at the threats from the West in the form of the Crusaders and the threats from the East in the form of the Mongols. The Mongols also mostly became Islamified. Crusaders didn't really stay around long enough. They took some cultural elements, but they weren't actually in the Middle East for very long. And we also started looking at factors that shape today's Muslim world, including the three great empires, sometimes called the Gunpowder Empires, the Ottoman Empire, which was based in Turkey, the Safavid Empire of Iran, and the Mughal Empire in India. And today we'll look at the impact of Western colonialism on Islam and how things have been developing since then. And we'll get up to the modern period. And then next week, we're going to go back to the beginning and look at some basic principles of Islam. And we'll also have a look at the modern landscape, like what groups are there out there. Okay, so around the time of those early gunpowder empires, things were changing enormously in the West. And in the 15th century, European explorers like Vasco da Gama and Christopher Columbus were pioneering sea routes that opened up huge areas of the world that Europeans hadn't been to before. In their wake, Europeans expanded into Africa, Asia, and the Americas. So you get the Portuguese turning up on the west coast of India in the 16th century. The British get in on the act in the 17th century, and they also start setting up colonies in, or certainly commercial colonies in India with the East India Company. And in 1757, Robert Clive replaced the ruler of Bengal with a British puppet king and started Britain's empire in India. By 1803, the British controlled Delhi, and the Mughal Empire just dwindled. The emperor was a figurehead and had no power at all. And in 1857, Britain introduced direct rule to India. And the Ottoman Empire also faced European inroads. They lost Hungary in 1699, and they were defeated very severely by the Russians in 1754. The Russians got a naval presence on the Black Sea. This may sound a bit topical. And the Russians also managed to get from the Ottomans the right to interfere anywhere in the Ottoman Empire if the rights of Christian minorities were at stake. And the effect of the European expansion was less direct in Iran. But after 1779, when Iran was ruled by a new dynasty, the Qajar dynasty, Iran very much became a pawn in the rivalry between Britain and Russia. And this trend of European expansion continued. So Napoleon conquered Egypt in 1799. The French seized Algeria in 1830. The British seized Aden on the Arabian Peninsula in 1839. And inevitably, whether they wanted to or not, the Muslim world was forced to react to the West, because there was the West on their doorstep, or actually beyond their doorstep and in their house. So the range of Muslim responses was not identical at all. And we need to understand what was going on at the time in the Muslim world. We've talked about some things. We've talked about the way in which the ulama, the caste of religious scholars, you could say like the rabbis, basically, of the Ottoman Empire had become a very conservative state bureaucracy. We talked about how the Safavids in Iran had promoted Twelver Shiism and basically destroyed Sunni culture in the country. And we talked about the Mughals adapting religious policy at certain periods to actually enable them to rule an empire with a majority that were Hindu at the time, with much more laid back policies. But there were other changes going on, especially in the role of religious scholars, the ulama, and in the role of Sufism, the mystical strain of Islam that we will do a session on later. So in contrast to the Ottomans, where you have the state bureaucracy of religious scholars, the Safavids in Iran had to import Shiite clergy because there weren't enough locals, but they didn't become part of a state bureaucracy. They were much more independent always than Sunni scholars, and they tended to question the legitimacy of any state that wasn't ruled by the Imam. You remember they had this idea of there was the proper Imam who was the descendant of Muhammad. And they also had differences among themselves. Some of them relied more heavily on text, religious text, as a source of authority, which is the Akhbari position. It's a bit more like the Sunnis. The other faction tended to feel that authority was vested in living scholars called mujtahids, people who engage in struggle to clarify legal points. You could say active researchers of Islamic law. And that's called the Usuli position. And under the Safavids, the Usuli won out. So that meant that you had this very bloody-minded clergy, if you like, class, who were not going to bow to the ruler. And they developed this idea that every individual should have their religious leader who would tell them what to do, very much like the idea about a Selech HaRav, you know, make yourself a rabbi. And in a way, this bypassed the state. And for Jews, there wasn't a state to bypass, but for Muslims, there was a perfectly good state. But the scholars claimed a much higher level of authority, and that we'll see later in the modern history of Iran. On the other side, the Sufi side, the mystical side, you get a tradition of reformers emerging who often claim to be going to purify or reform Islam back to what it was in the Prophet's day. They often came out of India. You had somebody called Sir Hindi in the 17th century who described himself as the Mujaddid, the renewer of Islam. And then an important early reformer, a little bit later, also from India, was Shah Wali Allah, who lived from 1703 to 1762. And he had visions confirming his feeling that it was his duty to purify Islam. So here's a little quote from some of his writings. "God granted to me the robe of revival and enabled me to give new vigor and guidance to this last age, laying a new foundation of present-day fiqh is jurisprudence, the process of deciding Islamic law." And he worked for the return of strong Muslim rule. You note he's exactly the period that the British are starting to get a foothold in India. And he even invited an Afghan warlord down to take control of Delhi, which didn't actually work. But he also led a theoretical idea that the ulama, the religious scholars, should be very important in leading Islam forward. And they were going to revive the intellectual tradition of Islam, particularly by studying the hadith, the oral traditions associated with Muhammad and his followers that supplement the Quran, if you like. Both he and other reformers of his type show some common characteristics. They all felt that Islam was in decline, partly because of the incursions of the West, because, you know, how could non-Islamic countries be taking over if God was on the side of the Muslims? The inference was clearly God was not very pleased with the Muslims. That's why the West was succeeding. So they had a duty to prop up Islam and purify it. And they also felt in each case that they were the right people to do this reforming. And very often it took the form of taking Islamic law more seriously and purifying it of what were seen as innovations, as later accretions that were not really proper. And both those features can be seen in another revivalist movement that still has implications today, and that is the Wahhabi movement of Arabia. And that started at this time in 1740. A scholar called Muhammad ibn al-Wahhabi, who died in 1792, started a really radical movement criticizing contemporary religious practice, which was very ethnic and folkloric, lots of holy tombs and praying for saints and magic and things like that, as happens in religions all around the world. And he preached a return to pure, unadulterated monotheism. And in 1744, he won over the local ruler of the Najd, which is the central highlands of Arabia. That's all Bedouin area because you can't farm up there. This ruler had a name that will be familiar. He was Muhammad ibn Sa'ud, who died in 1765. And they sort of set up house together. So you had al-Wahhabi and Muhammad ibn Sa'ud forming an alliance. And in 1803, they conquered Mecca, which was actually at the time under Turkish rule. And they destroyed the sacred tombs of the Prophet's nephew Ali, and of Abu Bakr, the first caliph, and of Khadija, the wife of Muhammad. So all these places that were holy and attracted pilgrims, they just destroyed them on the grounds it detracted from monotheism. They wouldn't let pilgrims from Syria and Egypt in. They banned tobacco, seen as an innovation. They destroyed all buildings connected with immoral behavior. I imagine that's the local brothels, probably. And they abolished all special signs of honor for people who were descended from the Prophet Muhammad. And in many, many Islamic societies, if you have a title, you're called Sayyid. If you are a descendant of the Prophet, and people, you know, it's a bit like being a Cohen. People, there's a slight residual respect for you. The unusual thing about the Wahhabis was they massacred their opponents, and that was completely new at the time. They argued that if people didn't agree with them, they were idolaters, they were heretics, kafirun, those who deny, and they said, fine, you know, those people can be killed. And that really was an innovation. People didn't do that in the Muslim world. You didn't just massacre your political opponents on the grounds they were heretics. And they created a Wahhabi state. And that was ended in 1813 by the Turkish governor of Egypt, Muhammad Ali, who himself became an independent ruler. So he reinvaded and retook Mecca. But a second Saudi state emerged in the late 19th century. And then the 20th century took its present form under another member of the Al Saud family. And they conquered the Hijaz, the sort of western coastal area, in 1924, 1925, you know, this is around the time of Lawrence Arabia, etc. And that's the foundation of modern Saudi Arabia. So that's why it's Saudi Arabia, just Arabia of the Saud family. And they were, and still are, very, very Wahhabi inclined. Not everyone in Arabia agreed with them at the time. The Wahhabis as a whole were very reliant on the 14th century scholar Ibn Taymiyyah, who came from Syria. We actually mentioned him earlier. He was pretty much against all this extra stuff about paying honor to tombs and you know, the intercession of saints and angels and shrines. He was against it all. And he wanted absolute, pure, untinged monotheism. And the Wahhabis followed him and saw idolatry absolutely everywhere. They thought Shiites were idolaters. They felt pilgrimages to saints' tombs and prayers were idolaters. And they characterized this with the word jahiliya, which is what we saw was the term used to describe the state of the Arabians before Muhammad turned up. It essentially means ignorance. So it's the pre-Islamic dark time of ignorance. So they basically said anyone who didn't agree with them was a jahili, was, you know, as bad as a pre-Muslim, just, you know, had no idea and hadn't listened to the Prophet. Worse than the pre-Muslim, because he hadn't had they'd had the advantage of hearing Muhammad's message. And he accused Al-Wahhabi himself accused other religious scholars of following their own desires, not the Quran. There's a very good book about it, which I put at the end of this, actually, by Khalid Abu al-Fadl, called The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists. Very dangerous book to publish, but he did. And that you can have a whole examination of how the Wahhabis sort of, I don't know, kidnapped much of Islam with this very extreme form. To give you an idea of what the Wahhabis didn't like, this is a wonderful passage from Rudyard Kipling's book Kin, which really, really gives you the flavour of contemporary folk Islam. And here, Kim is undergoing a magical rite. He could not see what the woman was about, but he heard the clish-clash of her jewellery for many minutes. A match lit up the darkness. He caught the well-known purr and fizzle of grains of incense. Then the room filled with smoke, heavy, aromatic, and stupefying. Through growing drowse, he heard the names of devils, of Zulbazan, son of Iblis, who lives in bazaars and paraos, making all the sudden lewd wickedness of wayside halts, of Dulhan, invisible about mosques, the dweller among the slippers of the faithful who hinders folk from their prayers, and Musbut, lord of lies and panic, Hunifa, who is the magician, now whispering in his ear, now talking as from an immense distance, touched him with horrible soft fingers. O hearer, thou that hearest with ears, be present. Listen, O hearer, Hunifa moaned, her dead eyes turned to the west. And I'll just skip a bit. I will lay a plot for their ruin. O prophet, bear with the unbelievers, let them alone a while. So you get an idea of Islamic magic, which there was Jewish magic, it wasn't too different from this either. This is the sort of thing the Wahhabis wanted to wipe out. They felt it was completely untrue to the original message of Islam, which it might well have been, that they weren't going to do this by means of education. They were going to be doing this by means of crackdown and banning and killing and burning down. So that was an unusual reaction to something that many people were disturbed by at the time. So from the 16th and 19th centuries, we can say that there was a rising feeling that things weren't right in Islam and that reform was urgently necessary, even though the precise causes of that decline might not have been agreed. And even though the recipes offered to reform Islam differed very, very widely indeed. But this feeling just continued to grow in the 19th century. And we can see two main responses to this and to the incursions of the West. The first one is opposition, which was sometimes violent to the West. And the second one was imitation of or acceptance of some Western values as the basis for reforming Islam. So we're going to trace those two contrary impulses. Okay. And the first can be characterized particularly by jihad movements, by movements of armed resistance. And that happened all over, certainly the British Empire, in Bengal in 1802, on the Northwest frontier, what is now Afghanistan, in 1826, and very famously in the Sudan, where a charismatic religious leader who claimed to be the Mahdi, the future leader of the Ummah, the Islamic community, captured the capital city of Khartoum and killed the British hero General Gordon in 1885. It wasn't just limited to the British Empire. The French found resistance to their takeover in the Sanusia, who were actually a Sufi group, and who also actually rose up in armed resistance against them. So you have these armed movements that react to the incoming invaders from the West. And you also have ideologues who arise at this point and sometimes are more effective in that their ideas continue, sometimes not terribly effective on a personal level. And some of them are quite odd. So there was a bloke called Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani, who died in 1897, who had a very odd career. Nobody quite knows where he came from, maybe Afghanistan. He moved to Istanbul. He was deported from there for heresy. That would have been the Turks thought he was heretical. He went to Cairo, gathered a group of disciples, notably Muhammad Abdu, the founder of Islamic modernism, and started publishing a newspaper calling for a return to the principles and ideals of Islam as in the Prophet's time. And he argued this would allow the Islamic community to prevail against the European powers. In the 1880s, he was involved in some British spying. And then he worked for the Ottoman Sultan as an anti-imperialist agent. He also spent time in Russia and in Persia, where he helped to encourage a resistance to a British tobacco monopoly, and also played a role in assassinating the Shah. So he was a bit of a dodgy guy. But his ideas did survive and were widely accepted in certain places. His idea basically was that Muslims should become politically unified and maintain their faith based on a religious social morality. But he was a great mass of contradictions. He said he was a defender of traditional Islam, but he also wanted all sorts of reforming and modern ideas. He wanted pan-Islamic unity, but he also supported Egyptian nationalism. And again, this sort of confused mix of various ideas, many of these get picked out and reused by later thinkers too. So he's an important figure, though a very, very strange one. And that, you could say, that's this sort of opposition was both, we said, the breaking out of actually armed resistance, and also on the ideological level, as we've seen with al-Afghani. Now, the opposite response in the 19th century was imitation. Okay, if you weren't opposing, you might be going, well, I don't know, you know, the West has done very well. Maybe we should learn from them. Maybe they do have something to teach us, and maybe we could incorporate that, and then we'll reform Islam in that way. So a classic example of that is the Indian Syed Ahmed Khan. We'll put his dates there, 1817 to 98. And he very much felt that, yes, Islam would regain its strength once it took on lots of 19th century modern values. And reading it now, it reads quite oddly. He says, the well-being of the people of India, especially the Muslims, which is an old-fashioned way of saying Muslims, lies in leading a quiet life under the benign rule of the British government. At this time, our nation is in a bad state in regards to education and wealth. But God has given us the light of religion, and the Quran is present for our guidance, which has ordained them and us to be friends. Now God has made them rulers over us. Therefore, we should cultivate friendship with them and should adopt that method by which their rule may remain permanent and firm in India and may not pass into the hands of the Bengalis. Whew. If we join the political movement of the Bengalis, this would have been advocating independence, our nation will reap a loss. But we do not want to become subjects of the Hindus instead of subjects of the people of the book, the British being Christians and people of the book. And he also said, Islam is nature and nature is Islam, which is a sort of an acceptance of science, you could say. It's saying that, you know, don't oppose modern science. That's also extremely Islamic. So he started off with quite conventional beliefs, but after the horrendous Indian mutiny of 1857, he started looking for a more authentic Islam, and he came into contact with European missionaries and scholars. And partly under their influence, he began to question the authority of the Hadith, these oral traditions. And he argued that only the Quran could represent the Prophet Muhammad's legacy. Mm-hmm. So he then reinterpreted the Quran on modern terms, modern here meaning 19th century. So the jinn, the evil spirits described in the Quran, he decided were not supernatural beings, they were just a particular Arab tribe. The devil, shaitan, which obviously is linked to Satan, was not a real being for him, but a symbol of the evil in human nature. And he explained all the miracles very nicely with natural causes. And he felt that there could be no contradiction between Islam and modern science, because Islam is nature and nature is Islam. He felt that both the word of God in the Quran and the work of God in nature must be true. And if they seem to conflict, then obviously you haven't quite understood what God is saying to you. And true to his admiration of the British, in 1875, he founded the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College, which he modelled on Cambridge. And it was a college devoted to educating the elite Muslim male class of British India. And the students played a lot of cricket, and they dressed like their colonial masters, and they often went on to government jobs. He did eventually have to distance himself from the religious curriculum because his ideas were just a bit too crazy for the contemporaries. And they brought in traditional scholars to teach the boys religion. It actually became Aligarh Muslim University, and it still exists. So this contrast between al-Afghani with his, you know, fermenting rebellions and this idea of all the Muslims uniting to throw off the West, and Syed Ahmed Khan saying, no, it's a very good thing we're being ruled by the West, and we should learn values from them, and that's how we should purify Islam, is really quite, gives you that spectrum of different responses to the incursion of the West in the 19th century. And it looked as though you had a choice between leaving the religion as it was and launching a jihad against the colonists, or doing a thorough reformation that looked a bit like a surrender to the external enemy because you were adopting too many of their ideas. But there were some common features, particularly assuming that a better future for Islam could be assured by going back to its past. And that's not unique to Islam. There are many religions that say when you get round to reforming, you go right back as far as you can and say, we have strayed too far from the original good place we were. For al-Afghani, that glorious past was the medieval rationalist philosophy of Islam. For Syed Ahmed Khan, it was a slightly earlier rationalist tradition. Interestingly, they both went for rationalism that tended to discount the Hadith. And they both assumed that Islam had taken a wrong turn and should return to earlier more pure forms of the religion. And that's the basic assumption behind, again, a modern movement called Salafism, which also has this, is still around, which still thinks that, you know, we've got too many add-ons, we need to go back to beginnings. It's pretty close to Wahhabism these days. So you get these different responses. There were other complicating factors. The end of the caliphate was pretty major. Now, the caliphate itself hadn't actually really lasted as an effective political unit. By the end of the 10th century, it didn't have much political power. We saw earlier the Mongols ended the Baghdad-based caliphate in 1258. Later on, the Ottoman sultans decided they were the caliphs. Nobody voted for this. They just decided. They didn't have much of a term, of a claim in traditional terms, because they didn't belong to the Quraishi tribe. And if you remember, the Sunni position was the caliph had to be from the Quraishi tribe, the same tribe as Muhammad, and they weren't. Still, they were calling themselves caliphs right down into the 20th century. And other Muslims sort of tended to accept this claim. And after World War I, the caliphate was very much under threat, because the fate of the Ottoman Empire, as you know, was a bit rocky by this point. Indian Muslims in particular rallied to the defense of the caliphate, and they even founded a movement called the Khalifat movement in 1919. But then you got the emergence of Kemal Atatürk, the architect of modern Turkey, who was a great, great secularist, a nationalist and a secularist. And he abolished the caliphate in 1924, just said, we don't need this anymore. He also thought it might serve as a focal point for his opponents to rally round. Once it was gone, there was remarkably little protest in the Islamic world, even in India. Quite a lot of Arab nationalists, especially in Syria and Iraq and Arabia, were very happy to see it go. They'd all been subject to the Ottomans, didn't like them, wanted their own independence, and weren't going to ask for a caliphate back that had been part of the oppressive system. But what it did do was it dealt a major blow to the hope for pan-Islamic unity, because if you didn't have a caliph to unite around, how are you going to unite all these different nations and languages and varieties of Islam? And in that sort of vacuum, the nation state, again, a very 19th century idea, became the ideal. And as Daniel Brown observes, if the Egyptians, Arabs, Indians or Indonesians had felt no shared nationality before, they certainly did after the French, British and Dutch consolidated their control. There is nothing quite like having one's land taken away to elicit a sense of common injury, the need for solidarity and the development of a shared mythology to support that solidarity. And looking back to the year 70 CE and the destruction of the temple, we certainly can see the resonances for Jews of that statement. Okay, so it's very much the same idea. Somebody else muscles in, does wonders for your own unity. But in these various struggles for national independence, the question of the identity of these new Muslim nation states that formed during the 20th century came to the fore. What could hold them together once the common enemy had gone? You know, what was the glue for these new societies? Was Islam sufficient? And there were plenty of nationalists who did not think so. So here's a Turkish nationalist, Ziya Gökalp. The land where the call to prayer resounds in Turkish, where those who pray understand the meaning of their religion, the land where the Quran is learnt in Turkish, where every man, big or small, knows full well the command of God. Oh, son of Turkey, that land is thy fatherland. In other words, it's got to be Turkish Islam. Now, traditional Islam, which, of course, the holy language is Arabic, is not good enough. So here Islamic tradition is being subordinated to good old 19th century nationalism. And a lot of people followed in that path. So by this time, by the end of the 19th century, just in early 20th, when you're coming up to the growing independence of Arab nation states and Islamic nation states, not just Arab ones, Muslims by that stage had been exposed to a century of Western ideas and concepts such as nationhood, popular sovereignty, representative government, and parliamentary democracy had spread throughout the Muslim world. But the question of what is the role of Islam was still not really very clear. What was the role of Islamic law in the new nation state? Again, we have parallels on what is the role of halakha in the state of Israel? So it's very much the same question there. What role should the ulama, the religious scholars, play? Again, we have that in Israel also. What role should the rabbinate play? And we don't have agreement on that either. So we can distinguish two extremes on these questions and a mainstream position that you could say is still developing. So extreme number one on the end of what do you do with Islam when you have a nation state is secularism. Best case study, of course, is Turkey. So in this idea, Islam was to have no state role or only a very subservient role in the functioning of the state. And in Turkey, Kemal Atatürk disempowered the ulama, the religious scholars. He banned polygamy. He abolished the religious legal system. He destroyed traditional institutions and closed down all the Sufi ones for a start. And he transferred education to the state and closed down all the religious schools, the madrasas. The Quran was translated into Turkish, and that was the translation that was used in prayer, not the traditional Arabic. The call to prayer was translated into Turkish. Friday, the holy day for Muslims, the day of, really, it's the day of gathering. It's not holy in and of itself. But Friday was replaced by Sunday to bring Turkey into sync with Europe and the West. And the traditional fez hat, which doesn't have a brim, so you can wear it very nicely when you're doing Islamic prayer, which involves bending all the way down to the ground, that was replaced by law with a brimmed European hat in which you can't do Islamic prayers. So Atatürk doesn't seem to have wanted to wipe Islam out completely, but he did want to transform it into a private religion that was conforming to rationality and reason and science and no political rule whatsoever. And here are some of his own words. The religion of Islam will be elevated if it will cease to be a political instrument, as had been the case in the past. In the face of knowledge, science, and the whole extent of radiant civilization, I cannot accept the presence in Turkey's civilized community of people primitive enough to seek material and spiritual benefits in the guidance of sheikhs. Sheikhs are religious leaders. The Turkish Republic cannot be a country of sheikhs, dervishes, and disciples. Dervishes are followers of Sufi orders. The best, the truest order is the order of civilization. To be a man, it is enough to carry out the requirements of civilization. The leaders of dervish orders will understand the truth of my words and will themselves close down their lodges and admit that their disciplines have grown up. Well, he might have been a little bit hopeful there, I think, because that didn't really happen. A slightly less extreme version to be seen in Egypt. For instance, Al-Azhar, the university, it's a medieval university. It was under the state. Egypt, the ulama are government employees. Sermons are written by bureaucrats. There it's been very much subordinated to the state, and is an official Islam in Egypt as part of the state apparatus, if you like. Other nations like Indonesia and Pakistan also went through very, very secular phases in the 1950s and 1960s. Before the revolution, Tunisia was extremely secular. Most of the French areas, Islam lost hold very much indeed, and secularity was the norm. There's still a movement for the secularization of Islamic states. They recently had a summit in Florida in 2007, and that advocates a Western-style complete separation of religion and state. And there are some figures there. We'll mention them again next week, but the extreme secular figures to watch, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is an ex-Muslim who's very anti-Islam, Wafa Sultan, also an ex-Muslim who's very anti-Islam, and Ibn Warraq, that's a pen name. It's not, nobody really knows who Ibn Warraq is, but also an ex, an anti-Muslim. And sometimes these people are trotted out as representatives of liberal Islam, but they're actually anti-religion altogether. So again, if you think about, particularly about the founding of the State of Israel, some of this sounds very familiar. The secularists versus the religious, the quarrels that are going on today. To the role of Judaism in the State of Israel. It's very much the same sort of story, and that is a product of 19th and 20th century ideas. So that's one end of the spectrum, the secularizing imperative. If we go to the other end of the spectrum, we have theories of the Islamic State. What is the perfect Islamic State? And that is still very, very important in the Islamic world. The idea of a modern Islamic state was popularized first by Rashid Rida, who died in 1935. He was a Syrian who spent most of his life in Egypt, was a leading figure in the Salafi movement, the Back to Beginnings movement. Salafis believe that Islam was perfect and complete during the days of Muhammad and his companions, but that undesirable additions have accreted over the years and should be got rid of. And again, we said that it's quite like Wahhabism, maybe not quite as fierce. But Rashid Rida had many modernist ideas as well. He wasn't all back to the past. He argued that Islam demands representative government, since the leader is ultimately authorized by the entire community. He wanted the refoundation of the caliphate, but he wanted it much more democratic. He wanted the ulama, the scholars, to represent the people. And what makes his system Islamic is that the chief task of a state like this would be to use Islamic law to run it. Again, rather like those voices in Israel that say halakha should be the law of the state, and that's it. That's all you need. You don't need any other law. And that's an idea that the idea of the Islamic state that has Sharia law, has Islamic law as its legal system, is pretty much universal among Islamist movements. Rida himself felt that the ritual side of the law, what's called the ibadat in Islam, it's very parallel to our idea of bein adam lemakom, the things that have been God and human beings. That should be entirely based on Quran and Hadith, but the social aspects of law, the mu'alamat, which is very, very much parallel to our idea of bein adam la'adam, the bein adam la'chavarol, between people, sort of social regulations, he felt that should conform to Islamic ethics, but it could be perfectly modern. He wasn't fussed about that at all. And this idea of the Islamic State was taken up and radicalized by one of the most influential modern Muslim movements, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan al-Muslimin. And that was founded in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna, who was an Egyptian teacher, who was a disciple of Rida. Banna, as we'll find out, died in 1949. It began as a youth organization dedicated to promoting religious values and combating secular ideas. It spread very rapidly. By the late 1930s, there were branches in every Egyptian province. By the late 1940s, there were 500,000 members in Egypt. And it was very modern. It had little local cells and a very modern leadership structure, liaised with the press, massive grassroots support, and they opened schools and clinics. And they supported the Arabs in Palestine and sent volunteers to fight in the War of Independence. Well, for them, it wasn't the War of Independence, but 1948, the Muslim Brotherhood sent soldiers. And they organized violent protests against Israel in 1948. And as a result, were banned by the Egyptian prime minister, who was then assassinated by a Brotherhood member 3 weeks later. And al-Banna was murdered in revenge the next year by the security services. So again, that's there's always been this, well, I'm not sure if it's love-hate relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. It's more like hate-hate relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood continued to exist. It has branches in 80 countries. It's the largest Islamist group still. It's banned in many Arab countries. Hamas was founded in 1987 by members of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the central plank of the Muslim Brotherhood is the creation of an Islamic state, but it's not at all clear what form that would take, because they've never had to do it. They've never gained power anywhere in the world. So it's still a bit on the back burner. They haven't really got the blueprints for what an Islamic state would actually look like. But two other aspects of its message have been very influential. And the first is the development of quite a new ideology of jihad and martyrdom. Now, we need to take a little detour here, because what is jihad? Jihad actually means struggle. And it appears as a word several times in the Quran. First, in the context of fighting against the people in Mecca who opposed the early Muslims, and in some cases tried to kill the early Muslims. And these verses in the Quran seem to refer to that context. Leave is given to those who fight because they were wronged. Surely God is able to help them, who were expelled from their homes wrongfully for saying, our Lord is God. And then we also have this very famous verse, and fight in the way of God with those who fight you, but do not transgress limits. You can imagine there's a lot of commentary on that. God does not love the aggressors. The Quran has other verses that actually encourage peacemaking, not fighting. So here's an example. If your enemy inclines towards peace, then you too should seek peace and put your trust in God. So as with many, many religious texts, it depends, you know, which ones you pick and how you interpret them. You can find most things if you look for it. So the versus sanctioned fighting were often used to justify the expansion of empires, that is, Muslim empires. However, fighting isn't the only meaning assigned to jihad. And equally traditional is the notion that there are four types of jihad that are recognized. There is jihad against the self, jihad an-nafs, like nefesh, the fight with your own evil inclination or the base parts of your personality. There is jihad of the tongue, jihad al-lisan, again, you can hear lashon, very close, which is the fight against lashon hara, the fight not to sin with your tongue. Jihad al-yad, the jihad of the hand, that's about correct action, fighting against yourself so you don't do bad things. And only the fourth one, jihad al-saif, jihad of the sword, is about war and fighting at all. So there's a well-known hadith about Muhammad, who comes back from battle and tells his followers, we return from the lesser jihad of warfare to the greater jihad, the struggle with the ego. So jihad has many meanings in Islam, and it doesn't necessarily mean fighting non-Muslims. That's one of its meanings. It's not the only meaning at all. Now, you can see that these texts can be interpreted in many, many ways. And as usual with interpretation, the person who's doing the interpretation is convinced that they've got the right one. Now, the Brotherhood's view of jihad was sharpened and shaped in the 1948 war against the Jews. And they felt that the concept of jihad had been softened down by Muslim apologists and Sufis and people like this. They wanted to ramp it up again. Al-Banna called for a return to militant jihad, first against the British in Palestine. And along with this, he also revived and restated the idea of martyrdom, which was not a big thing in Islam. And here's a bit of Al-Banna. Our permanent theme will be Allah is our objective. The messenger, Muhammad, is our leader. The Quran is our constitution. Jihad is our way. He meant military jihad, definitely. Dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. Now, the interesting thing about this is this came very close to an old heresy. One of the reasons the Kharijites were condemned was they encouraged the pursuit of martyrdom. You might remember the Kharijites were the group who assassinated the prophet's nephew, Ali, the fourth caliph, because he negotiated. And they felt that if a leader did anything like giving in to anyone else, negotiating and wasn't following what they thought Islam should be, that leader could be killed or removed. And the Kharijites tended to be very extreme. They all died out over the years. We said that the Abadis are the last surviving remnant, that they've changed a lot. They don't think of themselves as Kharijites. But one of the reasons why the other groups in Islam, Sunni and Shia, tended to condemn the Kharijites was they encouraged people to go out and seek martyrdom, and that was thought to be wrong. And an even more significant departure from classical Islamic thinking was the assertion that in the modern context, jihad is an individual duty rather than a collective duty. Again, medieval understandings of jihad was your society represented by your ruler has the right to proclaim jihad or initiate jihad, but individuals do not. So Al-Banna's introduction is Chiddush, if you like, while saying, no, everyone has a duty of jihad. So that is an innovation. And that's linked to the second major innovation of Muslim Brotherhood ideology, which again has spread very wide, the idea that modern Muslim states aren't truly Islamic and therefore they're not legitimate. And you hear this all the time. Everyone declares everybody else's state is not legitimate and therefore it can be attacked. So under this interpretation, modern Muslims are in the same situation as the very first Muslims. People who are in your approved group are surrounded by jahiliya, by wicked ignorance, and they're obliged to fight for the creation of a truly Islamic state, not like the one you currently live in. So the enemy there is no longer external. It's the godless regime at home. And this might be described as a neo-Kharijite ideology very much. It was developed by a very influential Indian journalist called Maududi, whose books were translated into Arabic in the 1950s. It was also taken up by a very radical member of the Muslim Brotherhood, Said Qutb, who wrote a book called Milestones, Malim Fitarik, which is still sort of the Bible of the Muslim Brotherhood and similar movements. They all go back to Milestones. And here he says it out loud and proud. A truly Islamic society is not one where people call themselves Muslims, but the Islamic law has no status, even if prayers, fasting and pilgrimage are practiced and observed. In other words, he is reserving to himself the right to decide what is a truly Islamic society. It's not good enough to live in a country where the main religion is Islam, according to Said Qutb. It is also not an Islamic society in which people follow their own version of Islam, contrary to what Allah and his messenger, peace be upon him, have prescribed and explained, and call it, for example, progressive Islam. Jahili, that's that word about pre-Islam ignorance, society appears in various forms, all of them in defiance of divine guidance. How to initiate the revival of Islam? A vanguard must set out with this determination and then keep going, marching through the vast ocean of Jahiliyyah, which encompasses the entire world. The trouble about that is, who's going to judge what is an Islamic society and who and what isn't? And obviously, Sa'd Qutb thought it was him. So the characteristic of these particular type of Islamist movements is they just decide that everybody else except for them is wrong. There's no appeal to anything much apart from, well, we don't agree with you, therefore you're wrong, therefore you're fair game. And that's something very new. That didn't exist before the 20th century. This idea that if you're not with us, you're against us, and then you're open to attack. Qutb himself advocated the formation of a new group of Muslim youth who would serve as this vanguard, and Milestones was written to guide them on their way. And his ideas set the agenda for radical Islamist groups throughout the Muslim world. They've been very influential, for instance, in the Egyptian Islamic Jihad and in Al-Qaeda. They're all fervent readers of Milestones. Now, that's not the only pattern that again, is important for what happens now in the world. Things were completely, completely different in Iran because it was Shiite. This is all Sunni stuff. So the search for the perfect Islamic state looks very, very different when you look at the Islamic Revolution in Iran, because it's Shiite in its evolution and its ideology. So you need a little bit of background. Reza Shah Pahlavi seized power in 1925 in Iran and was succeeded by his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, in 1941, person usually called the Shah. And his rule became increasingly autocratic. He had a lot of American support. He rapidly modernized Iranian infrastructure, but he simultaneously crushed all forms of political opposition. And had a horrendous intelligence agency called the SAVAK, which was very, very like the KGB. In opposition, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who you might remember, became a very active critic, and he publicly denounced the government. At that point, there was plenty of room to denounce the government. He was arrested, he was imprisoned for 18 months, and then he was exiled. And in 1979, some people may remember this, a series of demonstrations and mounting public opposition, by no means religious, actually ousted the Shah, and Khomeini returned. The country fairly soon after adopted a theocratic constitution. But many of the secular revolutionaries felt the revolution had been hijacked by religious extremists. A lot of them found themselves in prison. So the people who actually composed the revolution were by no means all religious, by no means. Some factors were unique in Iran and completely not there in the Sunni world, particularly the mixing of Shiite and Marxist ideas among urban youth in the 1970s. Also, the autonomy we mentioned before, the Shiite clergy who were used for centuries of taking decisions and having people follow them. And also the messianic expectations that you get in 12 of Shiism that says the hidden Imam is going to come back and lead us all to an era of world peace. The ideologue of the Iranian Revolution was Ali Shariati, who died in 1977. He'd been educated in Paris, and his thinking was very much a synthesis of Islamic ideas and Marxism. God was identified more or less with the people, so that justified revolutionary action in the name of Islam. And Shariati distinguished between official Shiism, the Shiism of the Safavid Empire, which he called Black Shiism, and revolutionary Shiism, typified by martyrs like the original Ali and his sons, Hassan and Hussein, and that he called Red Shiism. And his ideas were very, very popular among young people. And they provided a crucial link between the student vanguard and the much more conservative religious scholars. And together, really, those are the people who made the revolution and took it in this religious direction. And then there was a completely new element introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini. He had a new interpretation of the idea of viliyat-e faqih, the trusteeship of the jurist, the faqih, which is like the posek in Judaism, the trusteeship of the religious scholar, which justified the clergy taking over political leadership. And that was completely new. That was unheard of, still is unheard of anywhere else in the Muslim world. And here is a little bit of Ayatollah Khomeini's writing on Islamic government. Anyone who has come to general awareness of the beliefs and ordinances of Islam would unhesitatingly give his assent to the principle of the governance of the faqih, the scholar, as soon as he encounters it. The principle has little need of demonstration for anyone who has come to general awareness of the beliefs and ordinances of Islam. The entire system of government and administration, together with necessary laws, lies ready for you. If the administration of the country calls for taxes, Islam has made the necessary provision. If laws are needed, Islam has established them all. Everything is ready and waiting, which might be a slight overstatement. Of course, these ideas, whether in the Muslim Brotherhood form or the Iranian form, don't represent anything like the full spectrum of Muslim ideas about how Muslim countries should be governed. These two are up the other end from secularism. There's a vast amount in the middle we haven't really talked about. And what we've been talking about really, particularly with the ideas of Islamist movements, is the ideas of the radical extremists. And there was a Gallup poll some years ago, I think we did it over 6 years, and they estimated that no more than 7% of Muslims worldwide actually support this sort of radical extremism of the idea of the Islamic State, which would mean that 93% of Muslims don't support that idea. But these are the ideas that worry the West, and they continue to gain support for all sorts of reasons, a lot of them social reasons and modern reasons. So, for instance, the new communications technology is so much easier to find out about this stuff, and mass education, which means that more people are literate than used to be. The failure of Marxism and communism and other secular ideologies in the Muslim world, leaving a vacuum. The corruption of many regimes in the Muslim world and their failure to solve economic and other problems. The conservatism and low quality of many rural religious scholars who are completely alienated from modern life and don't serve as a resource. You know, they can't say anything to young people who want something different and new that speaks to them. It's just, you know, do what your dad did and shut up. So they are seen as irrelevant, and young people go out and look for these ideas. The effects of urbanization, which is increasing in the Muslim world on country people who are very used to a very laid back traditional Islam where it was cultural largely. You know, you didn't think about what you're doing. You did what everyone around you did. And of course, the strains of adapting to modernity, culturally, socially, economically. So all those things are actually continuing to make this an attractive set of beliefs for many, especially younger Muslims in parts of the world. What happens in the middle? All sorts of things. People often say to me, aren't there any liberal Muslims? I don't hear about any liberal Muslims. There are, but the press isn't very interested in them. There is a tolerant and reformist, if you like, Islam, which is still developing. First of all, it appears that the majority of Muslims, as we said, don't actually support radical Islamism. The Gallup poll, it was conducted across 130 countries, and it's, as I say, suggests that about 93% of the Muslim world aren't on board with that. And specifically, one question they asked, do you think the 9/11 attacks were justified? And 93% of Muslims said, no, we don't. There's a growing number of self-designated Islamic liberals. Many work in Western academic institutions. They are writing and speaking to promote a tolerant Islam, but they're not as good news values as people blowing up things. Many of them find justification for their position in the Quran, and they rely on verses like this one. If God had so willed, he would have made all of you one community, but he has not done so, so that he may test you in what he has given you. So compete in goodness. To God shall you all return, and he will tell you the truth about what you have been disputing. And they read that to mean God is happy with religious diversity. God is happy with human diversity generally. If God had wanted to, he would have made everybody the same religion. He didn't. Therefore, he sees it as some sort of friendly competition where each religion or community tries to be the best it can be and serve God in the way that they think is best and brings most of God's ideals to fruition in the world. And eventually God will tell us where we were right, where we were wrong. But in the meantime, we certainly don't need to start blowing people up or fighting them. There are other verses in the Quran that recognize that a multiplicity of religious beliefs and laws is a positive thing. And then again, how do they fit with some of the verses we already looked at that tell Muslims to fight or subdue or tax non-Muslims? And again, liberal thinkers like Fazlur Rahman, Khalid Abu al-Fadl suggest that particular commands of the Quran should be read in the light of general principles. So specific commands should be read in the light of their historical context. So some of those earlier verses we saw, they would say, okay, that is speaking to the first Muslims in Mecca who are defending themselves against persecutors. That's a specific historic incident. But verses like this, which aren't tied to a particular historical incident, would be the principle by which you interpret those other verses. You would say this is the ethical principle here, is God loves diversity, including religious diversity. Therefore, specific commands about fighting back at a time of persecution are subsidiary and historically constrained, and they don't represent universal principles, which this particular verse would. So that's how they would get around it. And again, Judaism knows things like this too. So they also point to the wider Islamic intellectual tradition, which has had quite a lot of tolerance of differing views. So the legal tradition in Islam accepts four schools of law as completely valid. You don't have, you've traditionally belonged to one or the other, but they don't compete. If you're a Hanbali, you know, you don't say that people who are Hanafi are traitor heretics. You say, okay, they're following a different interpretation of the law. So these liberals in the middle would argue that diversity and tolerance is a feature of traditional Islam, and that modern extremists are aberrant, not traditional in Islam at all. And again, if you look at the historical record, they do seem to have a bit of a point there. I've put some things to look at here. This is the Gallup poll book, John Esposito and Dalia Moggahed. That's a whole book examining the results of that six-year Gallup poll, which is interesting reading. Khaled Abu al-Fadl, who's one of the leading voices in what you might call liberal Islam, has written this book about how the extremists took over. He's particularly talking about the Wahhabis. And this is an academic book of liberal Islam, a source book, again, because people kept saying to me, well, I've never heard of it. So I've been looking, so, well, okay, there's a source book if you want to read what liberal Muslims are saying. There is a book published by Oxford University Press that's quite easy access, and you can look it up. So that's roughly taken us up to the modern day. And what I'm going to do next week is, I'm trying to sort of think actually which way around to do it. I could do basic principles of Islam first, and then we'll look at the modern landscape. Or I could do this is the modern landscape, and then we'll look at basic principles of Islam. I'll have to think about which way it'll work best. But we'll sort of do some chunking up and say, okay, these are the main positions or groups that you can find today. It'll rest on what we've learnt this week. Okay, I'm going to look at questions. With Turkish Islam, there's a funny story about Washington state legislator defending English over Spanish. That English, if it was good enough for Jesus, good enough for me. Yes, many people are under that delusion, yeah. Muslim Brotherhood formed a government after Mubarak for a short period. They did indeed, until there was a military coup that threw them out again. Could you draw a parallel between the secular state under Shah Reza Pahlavi and Ataturk? Were there some similarities, or was it significantly different? I don't know enough about it to tell you. I think the fact that Turkey was Sunni and Iran was Shi'i will make it quite different in some ways. I'm not sure that Ataturk was ever accused of being as corrupt as Reza Pahlavi was. But again, I don't really know enough about it. I think you'd have to go and read a book on modern Turkey and read a book on modern Iran and find out what were the similarities and differences. 7% says 70 million to 100 million. Can the authorities say the truckers' movement protests represents less than 3%? Okay. Well, yeah, you know. Okay, so the Shah's regime, yes. Sufis, yes, we're going to do a whole session on Sufis. Can we hear about tolerant Islam in Morocco? Well, I wasn't planning on doing anything particular. That may come a bit under the Sufi tradition. A lot of Sufis are involved in liberal Islam or liberal interpretations of Islam. A lot of Sufis are involved in interfaith. And there is also a crossover between Sufism and Judaism. Very famously, Maimonides' grandson was actually Jewish Sufi. So Sufism has influenced the Jewish tradition. It's a sort of mystical view. Would I recommend a particular translation of the Quran in English? It feels good. Yes, there's one by, oh glory, It's published by Oxford University Press. It's by Abdul Karim. Maybe I'll have to, I might have to come back to you on that. You want to be really careful, by the way, about which translation of the Quran you read, as of Tanakh, because some of them are sponsored by the Saudi government and they have some tendentious bits in there that aren't in the Quran. Some nasty bits about Jews and Christians that are definitely not in the Quran. So watch out. The Yusuf Ali, which is widely available in Britain, is very old-fashioned. If you're really interested, there's this, the Study Quran, which is very like the Jewish Study Bible. And that's got a whole range of, you know, it's got Rashi and Tosfot and everything, and a lot of interesting essays about the Quran. So that's, I'm slowly working my way through it. And I will definitely talk about translations of the Quran the week we do the Quran, and I will probably have all the information there. What else did the Muslim? Yes, we did that before. Are Sufis? Not really. I expect you could find some things where they cross over because there are mystical things in both. Sufis start out really early, and they're a current thread all through the Muslim world in different aspects. We're going to do a whole session on Sufism, so I hope it'll be easier to explain that too. The quote from Brown explains well the rise of Arab nationalism in Palestine in the 1930s. Indeed. The OUP book I shared before starting presentation. What, the translation of the Quran or the Study Quran, which is not OUP, this is Harper One. It's just called The Study Quran. And it's edited by S.H. Nasser. This is a new translation, I see, plus walloping great commentary. This is a hefty volume. It's thick. But I will talk about translations when we get that up. What about the Baha'i? The Baha'i are a sort of heresy that they added an extra prophet, Baha'u'llah, who's buried just outside Haifa, hence the big shrine in Haifa. So a lot of Muslims think the Baha'is are just wicked evil people because they've invented a new prophet and they're not allowed to do that. So they're not popular in the Muslim world. They're very persecuted in Iran, actually. I'm not sure if they're persecuted elsewhere. Any other questions that I haven't covered there? Does anyone want to ask a question verbally? I like Mormons with Joseph Smith.
I wanted to ask a question. I did put it on the thing. In after Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood did win an election in Egypt.
Yes, we just mentioned that just before. Yes, yes. Somebody else put the same question, and I said yes, they did for a while, but they were ousted by the army. Yes,
they were ousted by the army, but didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, we have just mentioned that before. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But didn't we see a little bit of how they wanted to govern from that time? I mean, obviously.
Yes, but they were only interested in whatever plans they had into practice. And it wasn't at all clear they'd thought it out exactly. You know, when you get down things like ecological protections and drainage and the sort of minutiae of education, it's very difficult to find that stuff in the Quran, whatever Khomeini said. Very, very much like, you can't find every sort of legislation you might want in halakha. There are great areas that halakha just doesn't really cover. You could say, well, there's a principle of protecting God's world, Baal Tashrit, but, you know, is that really going to give you laws on how to manage your environmental policies? Probably not. So I think this idea of, oh, you could run a state because Islamic law has everything. It's a bit like that, really. No, it doesn't have everything. You'd have to develop it. And there's not a lot of that most of these movements have actually done that hard work of developing this as what an Islamic state would look like under these particular conditions out there in the real world. So they're developed physiologically. And that's because they're focusing on the struggle. The hard, boring work of administering a country, they haven't had to do it yet. So the emphasis is on martyrdom and fighting and blowing people up. To put it mildly. Any other questions at all? Oh, Sam, sorry. Yeah. Unmute yourself and ask.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Was a Tariq a dictatorship or a democracy?
Who? Sorry?
Turkey under the secularism of Kemal Atatürk. Was it a democracy or a dictatorship?
Sorry, was who a dictatorship or a democracy?
Was Turkey, was the secular...
Atatürk.
Oh, Atatürk. Well, he did introduce democracy, but he was a bit sort of... I don't know enough about Turkish history, actually, to give you a good assessment. Because, you know, not all democracies are like each other. I think he did introduce national suffrage. How much control he had, I certainly don't know, because I'm very ignorant about modern Turkish history. So again, you'd really need to look at a modern history of Turkey and see how democratic was it. He was certainly this towering figure, so I think he had a vast amount of influence and respect beyond what you might expect your traditional democratic leader to have. But again, I daren't really answer that one because I wasn't, I just don't know enough about it, alas.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, good. Okay, was Napoleon like Democrat? Yeah, entirely possible. Again, you probably know better than I do because I haven't researched Turkey in any great detail. I'm better on Turkish art. Okay, I think we've done all the questions. Yep. Okay, so next week, back to basics. What is the core of Islam and what does the Muslim world look like these days? Okay. See you then.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah, I just, I don't know, B might be interested, but I believe that I've read some work by Moshe Edel, kind of looking at the possible influence of Sufism on various Kabbalistic movements. I'm not sure if he goes into Hasidism, but certainly kind of like the Tzfat mystics, Cordovero, Luria, etc. Yeah, I guess we'll...
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Something like that. But that's
I know
that's
about Abraham Benaramba, but I didn't know about that at all. So that's fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well,
wonderful. Looking forward to next week. And we have some new classes starting this week and as well another one next week. We sent out an email about that, but a quick little recap, there's a class starting tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. on Megillat Esther and readings of it over history. That's by Dr. Aaron Kohler. We also have Dr. Menachem Kellner on Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern. We're going to be doing a close reading of a few sections of Mishneh Torah, looking at kind of the Rambam's thoughts on the distinctions between Jews and Gentiles. And then what else? Excuse me. And calendar. Sorry. Slipped my mind. Of course, also we have a series starting looking at Jewish communities around the world. So various people that Torah in Motion has met over its travel programs will be interviewed by Dr. Mark Shapiro. So that's starting this Wednesday afternoon, 2 p.m. Eastern. And that's what's new this week. Looking forward to possibly seeing you there. Please invite a friend if you know anyone who might be interested. Thank you so much. Bye.